The Hearing, a legal podcast from Thomson Reuters.
Size is not a protected class in many places around the country, but New York, San Francisco, and Michigan have passed bills that outlaw discrimination based on weight and body size and shape. And so they're trying to make it on par with race and gender as far as being protected in that way. That gives a little bit more heft when it comes to making a complaint. That doesn't just mean like not being hired for a job. I mean, there have been stories about people not being allowed to rent an Airbnb or a hotel room to visit a certain restaurant. And so it gives a little bit more power to folks who feel like that they've been wronged because of the size and shape of their bodies.
Hello, and welcome to The Hearing. I'm your host, Janelle Wrigley, and today I'm excited to share a conversation I had about a topic that's not discussed very often in legal and professional settings, and that is the stigma and biases that are out there around body size and weight. My guest in talking about this today is Kara Richardson-Whiteley. She's the founder and CEO of The Gorgeous Agency, which helps companies become more body inclusive for their employees and clients. And she's also the author of a memoir called Gorge, My Journey Up Kilimanjaro at 300 Pounds. In our chat today, we dug into how judgments about weight and body size can sneak their way into all kinds of workplace dynamics. And that might be company policies, it might be who's getting chosen to get promoted, to get hired, and that includes certainly in law firms and legal departments. We also talked about some interesting new laws that are popping up in certain states that actually make it illegal to discriminate against someone based on their body size. And we talked a little bit about how the increasing use of GLP-1 inhibitors is changing some of the conversations around weight in the US. I thought Kara had a really interesting story to tell about her own journey, and she shares a really valuable perspective on how biases about body size, maybe even unconscious biases, might be affecting our workplace cultures and what we can do to improve that. So without further delay, here's my conversation with Kara Richardson-Whiteley on body inclusivity in the workplace. I hope you enjoy.
The Hearing.
All right. Hello, everyone. Thanks for joining us on The Hearing today. I have Kara Richardson-Whiteley joining me. Kara, thank you so much for joining me today on this episode.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You are the founder and CEO of The Gorgeous Agency. And I wanted to start maybe just asking you to tell us a little bit about what your agency is all about and the work that you do.
Of course. Yeah. I created the Gorgeous Agency because I felt like there was a gap in the market to serve the 67% of US folks who are in larger bodies. Sometimes I use the term plus sized. So that means size 14 and above. And this is a market that from the retail point of view, travel, and all sorts of different industries has been historically underserved. For example, I was just reviewing a statistic that, you know, only 12% of garments are made in plus sized. And again, there's 67% of US folks are in larger bodies. So there was a huge gap in the marketplace. And where that really morphed into was also talking to folks in HR and in legal about size discrimination, because at the root of all of it is weight stigma. And there's a lot of weight stigma in the workplace. So I've been brought in to speak to companies about weight stigma and what does it mean to be body inclusive and what kind of commonplace conversations are happening and actually doing harm and hurting not only your attraction of talent, but also the retention of them as well.
Yeah. And I mean, it's fascinating to think that, as you mentioned, 67% of Americans are in larger size bodies. And yet it's not something that I feel like we really talk about that openly, certainly the workplace, but even in just kind of the larger conversations around inclusivity and diversity. Why do you think that is? Or do you have a sense from talking to companies about where that stigma is coming from?
You know, that's a great question. I've really built my career on talking about weight when a lot of people are really uncomfortable doing so. I wrote a book, Gorge, My Journey Up Kilimanjaro at 300 pounds, which is being made into a movie. I know we'll talk about that later. And so I've always felt really comfortable talking about my relationship with food, my relationship with my body. And in fact, writing and talking about it has been a really healing point of view for me. But I also noticed that people are really, really hesitant to talk about weight when, in fact, it's one of those invisible things that, you know, the larger you become, the more invisible that you are to the marketplace, to the workplace, to all of the above. And so it was really fascinating for me to start to open the conversation because people are so nervous about talking about it. And also, I mean, I think that people harbor a lot of weight bias and weight stigma unknowingly. You know, it's that unconscious bias that a lot of folks talk about. But with weight, it's kind of one of the last things that people haven't really addressed yet, really head on anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm looking forward to chatting with you about in more detail about that work that you do, especially, I think, for our audience. The legal industry, I think, you know, there's all kinds of stigmas, and they're kind of conservative with the small c environments in terms of, you know, how people are expected to present themselves, and so I'm looking forward to chatting with you about, you know, how things might play out in an environment like that, but a little bit more on your background and how you kind of got started. You know, what is your kind of professional background? What led you to actually starting the agency to work in this space?
Yeah. So I started the Gorgeous Agency after years of being a storyteller, and that was being a journalist. I was a journalist for more than a decade. And I also worked at a branding agency, Monaco Lang, which was an incredible group of people in New York City. Working for clients like Girl Scouts in the United States. And then I've morphed into, you know, being a full-time author. Meanwhile, you know, also being a consultant and working on people's marketing campaigns. And so I really used that foundation of storytelling, of getting to the heart of things, having difficult conversations, because, you know, if you've seen a newspaper, you know that there's a lot of difficult stories out there. And so creating that content that connects with people has always been at the heart of what I've done. And so when I was starting my agency, I thought, how can we communicate better? How can we create content that really connects with this audience who's been just left out of the conversation for so long? And so that's really been at the heart of what we do. We, of course, when we work with clients, we do a tremendous amount of trainings, you know, whether it's an ERG, just talking about moving mountains, or more in depth about weight stigma in the workplace and what it could really cost you.
Mm-hmm. Right. I think you had a white paper talking about the rise of the body inclusive economies and the benefits of really creating a more inclusive environment or marketing in a more inclusive way. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Some of the, what businesses are missing by kind of overlooking the 67% of Americans?
Yeah, of course. Well, it really just comes down to math, right? I mean, if we're talking about 67% of the U.S. population who is not often marketed to, with more than $40 billion in market buying power, this is a market that is really interesting to navigate. But the tricky part with this segment is the customer journey itself, because this is an audience who has often been left behind in the conversations, often been out of the image, or, you know, they go to the store, a brand says they have plus sizes, they get to the store, they've got their money in hand, and the person there says, oh, you can buy that online. And so again and again, this consumer has had the rug pulled out from underneath them. And so what we really specialize in doing is that customer journey reorientation. Like, how do we get someone to trust this brand all over again? Mm. You know, maybe they have had plus sizes or catered to this market, but there's been some missteps, some failings, or not any consideration at all, which is also mm-hmm. something that needs to be corrected and course corrected when it comes to the customer journey. And so there's a lot of psychology behind the path that needs to be paved for this segment because of how many bridges have been burned. Right. What it really comes down to is that weight stigma is complex trauma. You have to look at it that way. Complex trauma is the kind of trauma that happens again and again and again, everywhere, from everything. It's the kind of thing that, you know, it's coming from media and society. I mean, think about, you know, social media posts and how much pressure there is to be in a smaller body when maybe your body was just built the way it is, right? Or maybe you've lost weight and now you've gained it again. So there's so many messages coming from the world around you about the size and shape that you should be. Mm-hmm. But then it's also coming from authority figures. And so that might be your boss, that might be your workplace, whether it's the imagery that doesn't include people like you, or also just little comments, little microaggressions about what you're eating or asking about your exercise habits that just don't stop. But I think that the most heartbreaking part of what we do and our work in weight stigma is that oftentimes that this weight stigma is coming from the people that you love and care about the most, right? Mm. So it's coming from your family and your friends as well. And where it gets really complicated for this segment is that it's often done in the veil of like, oh, it's for your own health. Mm-hmm. I'm doing it for your own good. I'm making these comments about what you're eating and how you're moving to help you, when studies show that the exact opposite is true. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, this cycle of weight stigma is something that, you know, it carries over into a lot of social isolation, disordered eating, anxiety, and depression. And really just, you know, that social isolation from a business point of view, you can think of it like, you know, disengaging from a brand, mm-hmm. disengaging from an activity. Think of, when I speak around the country, I hear so many different stories about people who have signed up for a gym membership because they want to move, right? Mm-hmm. They want to feel stronger. They want to do what's best for their body, which is exercise. But because of the way that a trainer interacted with them, they're still paying that membership because they don't dare go back into that building, and yet they haven't set foot in it. And this doesn't have anything to do with like, oh, I just want to be lazy and, you know, not work out. It's because someone in that gym has wronged them. Right. And the brand reputation is absolutely tarnished because of the way that they were treated, because of the size of their body. And because oftentimes that kind of commentary about someone's body or making fun of them or laughing or giggling or, you know, all that stuff like that is socially acceptable.
Right.
But it's doing a tremendous amount.
And you think about how vulnerable somebody must feel in that moment when they're stepping into a gym. Maybe they haven't been in a long time. And, you know, I imagine it wouldn't even take, you know, it's just a sensitive moment for them or for many people, I would think. Right. And then they'll never come back if there's not that kind of sensitivity around welcoming those individuals.
Exactly. And like, you know, we work with a lot of travel destination focused clients. And so think about, you know, if you are in a family and you've booked something like you really, really, really want to do, like kayaking at your destination. And, you know, you've convinced your kids that it's a good idea and your partner and you show up and you can't fit into the kayak, right? So there's so many things along the way, and maybe the outfitter or the, you know, can only afford these kinds of kayaks, but the transparency that is required to just kind of give someone a heads up that this experience isn't going to fit them is so important, because if you're there and being humiliated in front of your family, I mean, that kind of pain, it changes the trajectory of that person's purchases for decades.
Right.
For decades.
Speaking of kayaking and kind of outdoor adventures, you're an outdoor adventurer yourself. And you mentioned your hike up Mount Kilimanjaro, which I think you've done more than once, but and the book that you wrote about it called Gorge, My Journey Up Kilimanjaro at 300 pounds. So I wanted to ask you a little bit about that. I mean, just starting with what inspired you to take on that challenge? Were you already, you know, into outdoor adventures like that? Or is that something you kind of took on for the first time?
Yeah, I mean, my climb up Kilimanjaro began on a 20-minute hike in New Jersey, right? every major mountain in your life starts somewhere way smaller, you know, with the first few steps. And I was about to turn 30 years old. And at the time, I thought I was getting pretty old. So I got this adventure travel catalog in the mail, and it had these amazing photos of Machu Picchu, Kilimanjaro, and the Alps. And I started to think about how I was living my life with this idea that, like, oh, I'll do these vacations and go on these hikes when I lose weight. And how much of my life was just on pause by that clause, right? That small little, when I lose weight, I'll go get a whole new wardrobe. When I lose weight, I'll go to the doctors when I lose weight. So many things on my life were completely on pause. And I was standing at the mail slot with this amazing catalog in hand, Machu Picchu, Kilimanjaro, and the Alps. And I thought, well, I want to do that now. You know, I don't want to wait anymore. I want to start heading in the direction of these places. And so I decided that I wanted to start identifying as a hiker girl. And that's challenging, because when I started hiking a few decades ago, if I went to an outdoors type store, I'd have to buy a men's jacket to go hiking. And that would mean the proportions would be all weird. And even if it was a 3X, like, the sleeves would be too long. Mm-hmm. It wasn't fitting in the hips and all those things like that. And so I went to this hiking store, and the only thing that I could purchase was the 50 Hikes of New Jersey book and a Nalgene bottle, the kind of water bottle that it fell off the side of the mountain, it would survive and you wouldn't. Like, I needed like a legit water bottle, because, you know, if you do an actual Google search of hiker girl, I mean, check out the images that come up. They don't look like me. I mean, I've been in a larger body since I was, 9, 10 years old, and I don't look like the marketing model of, you know, outdoors brands. And so that water bottle was my entree to the outdoors. And so I remember thinking about that first little loop. Actually, I just did it with my daughter this weekend. We only did this small loop because it had been raining like crazy, and we didn't want to do too much trail work because there was so much damage on the trail from all the rain.
Yeah.
But that first time when I went hiking there, you know, I was suited up like I was going up Everest or something. Like, I had like a 3-day supply of food. I had like a bear bell. And, you know, the thing is like, I'm hiking in New Jersey. If I'd gotten lost, I'd probably end up in like a Target parking lot. But I mean, it just gives you an idea of like trying something new when you are harboring all of these other negative experiences that have been tainted by other people's thoughts about you being a fat person at a gym and in the wild, you know, trying out this new job, a new hobby. You know, there's so many steps that I had to take to feel like I was ready to start, even just start on the tiniest little trail. Mm-hmm. You know, I felt like I needed to have the best possible supportive boots and all the things that like would have made me feel legit in this space of the outdoors. And so one step led to the next and led to the next. And I just kind of made my way through that 50 Hikes of New Jersey book. And it was incredible to see the transition from like being terrified to being like really excited about like, mm-hmm. okay, what am I going to do this weekend? What am I going to do next weekend? And what's the plan here? And, you know, I share very publicly that I struggled with binge eating disorder since I was a kid. And so binging was all about pushing away emotions that felt uncomfortable to me. So, you know, even from the time I was 9 years old and my parents were on the verge of divorce, I literally would hide in the cabinet and the sounds of crunching would drown their screams at each other. And so food and distancing myself from emotion was my MO. But when I was hiking, it was all about pulling it in. It was about becoming closer to the fear, to the excitement, to the joy, to the sorrow. Like if you hike an entire mountain and you don't get a good view, like because it's cloudy, you know, all these things can happen on the trail. And I loved it. I loved that I, for the first time, was truly pushing myself towards all the things, all the feels. And so because this starts happening and I'm like peak bagging, you know, I'm peak bagging. I'm checking off all the trails. I'm going to do more and more. And, you know, I did, I went to the bottom of the Grand Canyon and thankfully back up again without the assistance of a mule. I did Camel's Hump, which is a hike that I had to turn around from as a college student because I was ill-prepared and very, very sick with binging.
So you went, and then you were able to go back from this new perspective. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's
wonderful. And I started to, you know, I started to get the attention of people in my workplace because I was moving my body more. I wasn't relying on binging for my feelings. And so the thing that started naturally happening for me is that I started to lose a significant amount of weight, like a three-digit kind of weight loss, because I was moving so much and fueling my body for movement instead of fueling emotions. Mm-hmm. And so it was the strangest thing for me because like people wouldn't even look me in the eye before, like at my heaviest weight, and they didn't know my name. They probably just call me that fat girl who's a reporter, you know. And now everyone had to follow me into the bathroom to find out what I was doing and was I on South Beach, you know. Now, you know, so there was just so much of that like conversation. It was so awkward, especially because I'm somebody who created distance with food and fat, you know. So I thought, how am I going to change this conversation? How do I, as my therapist would say, reframe this, this kind of conversation? And I had my eye on a very special mountain, which is Kilimanjaro. It's Africa's highest peak, 19,343 feet, but who's counting?
And I'm sure you counted every one of those steps.
Every single one, right? And it's like climbing the side of the globe because you start at the equator and you end up at glaciers. So this was a very, very special climb and felt like it would be a monumental accomplishment. And so anytime someone asked me about my weight loss, I said, well, I'm climbing Mount Kilimanjaro and I'm doing it to raise money for AIDS orphans in Africa at Global Alliance for Africa's programs. So here's where you can donate. And that strategy was very effective. I raised more than $1 per foot of the mountain just by changing their conversations.
Yeah.
And you know, they got people quiet very quickly when I just was asking them for money anytime they brought up weight. So
Reframe.
Yeah.
And what was the experience like of going up the mountain for the first time?
Yeah, I think what I love about Kilimanjaro is that, you know, at that altitude, you learn very quickly the strategy of pole pole, which in Swahili means slowly, slowly. The slower you go up the mountain, the better, because, you know, there's half as much oxygen at the top of the mountain as there is at sea level. And so the slower you go, the more easy it is for your body to acclimate. So I'm like, this is my kind of mountain. you know, and camping and eating, you know, out on the mountain. It's just, it's so magical and also grueling. And, you know, going 6 days without a shower is not for everybody.
Yeah.
But it's really a test of moving yourself forward, no matter how you feel. Obviously, mm-hmm. if you're so sick from altitude, you do have to turn back. But also, I mean, this is the extreme version of pulling in every single emotion. And anyone that I know who's climbed Kilimanjaro has wrestled with something on the mountain, because mm-hmm. at a certain point, you run out of things to say to the people mm-hmm. next to you, and all the deepest, darkest thoughts that have surfaced, it will surface. And one of the greatest lessons of climbing Kilimanjaro, and in my own recovery of, you know, binge eating disorder and my own path forward is of confidence, is like, when something is bothering you, you need to deal with it. Mm-hmm. So how that translates on the mountain is like, if you feel like you're getting a blister, well, you better treat it, or you really will have like a gaping mm-hmm. hole in your ankle. If you are thirsty, you need to drink. If it's raining, you need to put on your rain jacket or cover your backpack. And if something is really bothering you on the mountain, you need to say something. And so that art of having difficult conversations was really amplified on mm-hmm. on Kilimanjaro. And whether that's a difficult conversation that I'm having with myself in my own mind, right. and really kind of processing through, okay, what am I thinking about here? What does it mean? What's the path forward? But also, if someone is doing you wrong, as which happened on my third climb, where the porters and guides were openly betting against my track up the mountain. Wow. You know, you do need to say something.
Right. Yeah. Have you found that your experience and you wrote a book about it and talking about it has helped, you know, opened people's eyes, changed people's minds, the companies that you work with, the brands that you work with, in terms of, you know, what's possible for people in larger bodies, and just sort of reframing their own biases?
Yeah. I mean, when I'm doing a moving mountains conversation for clients, I'm there to help folks realize that they can overcome obstacles. It may have nothing to do with weight, but sometimes people feel really stuck. And so I've worked with clients and companies that are going through a tremendous amount of change. And that's mm-hmm. when they want to bring in this idea of, like, you know, one step at a time, keep moving forward, right? Or having difficult conversations, and, you know, how to absolutely bet on yourself and your own success. Mm-hmm. When it comes to writing, you know, I was really afraid when I wrote Gorge. First, my first draft of it was really like a fat girl goes on an adventure kind of story. It was really, you know, like, I did this, I did that. And I think when you start writing, that's how you usually write. I mean, I was a journalist, so I relied just on the facts. And I wanted to mm-hmm. tell you the facts of what had happened. And my agent had a look at it, and she said, you know, Cara, you know, 2/3 of the United States struggles with their weight in one way or another. And then the other third does, but you can't really see it because they're not in larger bodies, right? Everybody's got a really complicated relationship with their body and with food. So it doesn't matter what you put on the table here in this book, someone is going to nod their head and relate to it. And so it was a real reminder to me that I do need to go there, and I need to write in a way that reveals all, because someone will feel seen. Mm-hmm. Someone will feel like they're not alone. Someone might have the courage to take on their own adventures. And, you know, one of my best friends is someone who started as a real fan of the book, Arwen Turner. And she started hiking again after she found my book in REI. And it changed everything for her. And
that's cool.
Now she even started her own pants company, Thicket Adventure.
Cool.
Yeah, because she wanted to create pants so more people could enjoy mm-hmm. The outdoors. And so, yeah, it's had a real impact on people who have felt left out.
Yeah. And it's being made into a movie. What is it like to see kind of a part of your life, chapter of your life, being translated onto the screen?
Yeah. Well, first of all, it's a very, very long journey and full of Hollywood twists and turns, flat foot twists and turns. And you think it's going to happen one way and then things change. And so when you watch the Oscars and they're like, oh, it took 20 years to make this movie, believe them.
Yeah. You're like, no, I get it.
It's a very slow process. So slow that sometimes I forget that it's happening and that it's in the works. But yeah. Chrissy Metz is, she played Kate in This Is Us. She wanted to support the project and help me make it into a movie after she had read Gorge. And, I'd given her a copy at one of her book signings and she reached out to me a couple months later, like, how can we make this happen? And so that's been really, really fun. And she's just a wonderful human being and partner in this.
Yeah, that's fun. Well, we'll keep an eye out for it, but understand it may take a while.
Yeah, patient. Pole.
There you go. Step by step.
The Hearing. You're an attorney with a passion to perform, a drive to be absolutely on your game. With superior resources, serious preparation, and total confidence, be your best with Thomson Reuters Practical Law.
As allegiances are tested.
You're gambling with World War III.
And regimes fall.
Fighters and civilians continue to stream in from other parts of Syria.
No matter where the story is, Reuters World News podcast is there. We make sense of the news shaping our world and give you everything you need to know in a 10-minute podcast every weekday. I'm your host, Kim Vanell. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
So our audience, you know, here at The Hearing is mostly legal professionals, people working in the legal industry in various ways. So I did want to talk to you a little bit about, and you touched on it already, but, body inclusion, body diversity in the workplace, and kind of from two angles for lawyers, I think. On the one hand, lawyers are sort of advising their own clients about workplace policies and sort of needing to understand the legal environment around discrimination. But the other is just as people themselves. Lawyers are working in all kinds of environments, law firms and legal departments. So to start out in all of this, I was curious for your take on, how you've seen body inclusivity be part of the discussion or not part of the discussion relating to diversity and inclusion over the past, several years.
Yeah, it's been kind of a fringe conversation. And what we found at the Gorgeous Agency is that our best clients are truly invested in inclusion. We get a lot of people saying like, oh, you really need to work with this company. And if they're not committed to inclusion in other spaces, then they may not be a great fit for us because what it boils down to is that, if you want to be a company that is welcoming all and really meaning it and taking action to make that happen, those are our best clients. And so, yes, the beginning of this year was downright brutal and I think for any company that does any kind of work, whether it's government funded or also in the space of diversity, equity, and inclusion. And also it's been really clarifying on where people stand in the world around you. And so as gut-wrenching as it was to watch, the people who I hold near and dear professionally, either losing their positions or losing clients and myself doing the same, it's provided a lot of clarity in what brands are committed in this stake of welcoming all and reaffirmed our work in, our work is in inclusion. And also, like we talked about earlier, it's also math. Sooner or later, companies will learn that inclusion work is good business. Right. It's just good business. I mean, if you're going to turn your back on 2/3 of the marketplace, well, I don't know what to tell you, people.
Including in hiring, right? Not just who you're marketing your products to, but the talent.
Exactly. Hiring, especially because, you know, if you are not going to, if you're going to have unconscious bias when it comes to hiring at folks or not advancing their careers or paying them equally, well, they'll go somewhere else. They'll take their talent somewhere else. And so, I mean, what have we learned in this drawback of diversity, equity, and inclusion is like, that's a terrible idea. That's a horrible. And you see it with the steadfast decline of Target.
Yeah.
And you see the rise of those companies who've said, oh, yeah, no, that's a pillar of who we are. We're not backing down. Like, you know, examples like Costco and Marriott. And I was just quoted in the Daily Brew about REI, you know, doubling down on their inclusion efforts and whether or not that's a good idea. And of course, it's a great idea. Mm-hmm. I mean, the outdoors should be open to all, you know. Every business should be open to all, and size should be part of that equation.
Right. Absolutely. You mentioned earlier, or you just in passing about, you know, the possibility of kind of bosses, managers making offhand comments that can be kind of make people feel excluded. I was curious, you know, if there's other types of experiences or unconscious biases that people in larger bodies may be experiencing in the workplace that others may not be aware of or may be aware of, but need to do better.
Yeah, of course. You know, I think it's really important for people to know that weight stigma is, you know, pervasive in everyone's career from the moment that they're looking for work to when they're, you know, in the leadership level. So it impacts folks first in the hiring process. There's a lot of recruitment bias where people are assigning stereotypes to people in their body sizes just by looking at them and not really looking deeper at their resume and what they bring to the table as a team member. Mm-hmm. Second, there's a pay differential typically between people in larger bodies and those in standard sizes, right? They're historically paid less than their colleagues. Wow. Often also they are promoted less often. The advancement is not as prevalent, again, because folks assign stereotypes like this is the kind of performer this person is. Or, you know, I've heard stories about people being told that they need to look the part of the next role within the company. And so, and that's a not so subtle suggestion for them to lose weight. And then, you know, in the leadership roles as well. Like there's just not a lot of folks in larger bodies and in leadership positions. And so like, you know, people see that. And I even see that in, you know, I often work with retail clients and think about, they can't hire enough staff, right? But they don't make clothes for the 67% of people who are looking for jobs. So they work at your company. They can't wear what you sell, right? And even if they come to work and then they have to wear something else, or they can't take advantage of the discount on the apparel. So it's just this strange cycle of like not working or like, you know, a hotel job. Maybe you need a uniform and they don't carry your size or you're embarrassed to ask. And, or, you know, just making an inclusive workplace or just environment. So imagine how uncomfortable and unwelcomed you would feel if you show up to an interview and the chair was too small. It had arms, you know? So there's so many things that we help companies think through that will start to erase some of these barriers and to just be more mindful about the process so that they don't miss out on the talent and of folks.
So in addition to kind of addressing culture issues and just mindfulness, are there other things that companies can do to create, you know, more inclusive environments? I mean, do you see companies having sometimes formal policies, you know, do they help? I don't know. Or, you know, you mentioned trainings, like what other types of things can organizations think about?
Yeah, trainings are great. And, you know, This can lend itself well into policies, right? I was talking with a travel client of ours, and they talked about how oftentimes they host people who are planning conferences from around the world, and so they might book their ticket for them because they're creating this incredible event, which will bring thousands, if not millions of dollars to the local area. And so the simple question of like, what if they need two seats? You know, how do we make that easier for them to say that they're in a larger body and they need two seats on the airplanes? And there are so many different airplanes that have really neat policies about like, if you buy two seats, they'll refund the second, you know, but if you start to get to know those things, you can make this journey of connecting with this destination so much easier.
Right.
And I mean, but just imagine if every step of the process was met with like being uncomfortable, unwelcomed,
right,
and not seen as a real human being, how that could go awry and you lose this massive opportunity. And so there's, you know, we do marketing audits for clients where we're taking a look at what their materials look like. Where are their opportunities? Because every business is so different. And, you know, that's why the work we do is often very bespoke. Our processes are there, but like oftentimes the solutions are rather bespoke because, you know, it depends on the kind of work that they're doing.
Right.
Have a look at uniforms. What are the options? Who are other vendors they could be talking with? And then also just, you know, trainings is the beginning of the conversation and the ongoing kind of consulting that we do to make sure, for example, if you have an employee outing, like think about that. Do you have like t-shirts that you give to everybody and then suddenly they don't have the correct size? Or are you going on a kayaking trip and no one thought to check? What's the weight limit? You know, and this is, you know, this is the kind of stuff that you should be thinking about from an accessibility point of view.
Right.
Anyway, right. And weight can sometimes be an accessibility issue as well.
Yeah. I mentioned earlier that, you know, I tend to think of the legal industry as being fairly, you know, it's kind of has a, I don't want to insult our, the industry at large, but the legal industry can be, you know, conformist, a bit conservative. There's certainly, I think, at least when I was practicing, ideas about how you should dress, what you should look like, and not wanting to kind of step too far outside of the box. And that's probably true of other corporate environments as well, of course.
Sure.
So have you worked with clients like that, that are, you know, in these kind of, you know, corporate environments that may, you know, have more to overcome in terms of being accepting of more diversity and just how people present themselves, whether it's being in a larger body or you know, whatever it may be? Is it more challenging in some ways to kind of change the culture in certain environments?
Well, I mean, I think in the legal industry, it might be a little bit easier because once the awareness is there, then, you know, then the systems become, you know, easier to put into place, right? You know, oh, maybe somebody needs a larger chair, or maybe we shouldn't talk about, you know, how many calories are in this, and make comments about like, I shouldn't eat that cookie because I'll be so gross for the beach this weekend because you're not being mindful of the people around you. And I should, you know, add a caveat here that the kind of work that we do isn't just for people who are in larger bodies or fat or obese, whatever term you want to use, right? Because you have no idea what the history is of someone's body, right? And their family and the people they love right? So you don't know if your constant talk about how many grams of protein you're having today is triggering, right? And how much that kind of conversation is off-putting, or talking about the latest celebrity who has done this, done that, or is on GLP-1 medications or not. Those kinds of conversations about weight and body that are commonplace can be really harmful to people in all sorts of bodies. You know, you don't know if someone's mother or their partner or their whatever is in a larger body and who you're really insulting and turning off for business or for being a team member as well.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I wanted to also ask about, you know, legislative efforts that may be out there, or, you know, models, whether in the U.S. or elsewhere. I think I read that there's legislation, or had been in the past, in New York and Colorado that mm-hmm. had been proposed to ban discrimination based on weight or body size. So I wonder if you could tell us maybe a little bit about those efforts in the legislative arena.
Yeah, and I think that where this gets tricky from a legal point of view, and I'm not a lawyer, and I don't ever pretend to be one, so catch me here if I say the wrong thing. But you know, New York City recently passed a law that banned size discrimination, and that, again, we're not just talking about people in larger bodies. We're talking about people who live with dwarfism. We're talking about people who are extra tall, extra small, extra, you know, all of these things that. A reason for someone to say, oh, I don't want that here. I can't make accommodations here. It opens the door for legal retribution for mm-hmm. the people who have been harmed by people judging them based on their size and shape. And so, size is not a protected class in many places around the country, but New York, San Francisco, and Michigan have passed bills that outlaw discrimination based on weight and body size and shape of all kinds. And so they're trying to make it on par with race and gender as far as, you know, being protected in that way. So there have been state level bills that have been introduced in New York, Massachusetts, Vermont, and New Jersey, my home state. So it's exciting to see where that goes from here. But, you know, that gives a little bit more heft when it comes to making a complaint, feeling like someone's been wronged. That doesn't just mean like not being hired for a job. I mean, there've been stories about people not being allowed to rent an Airbnb or a hotel room to visit a certain restaurant because of the way that someone looks as far as their body shape and size goes. And so it gives a little bit more power to folks who feel like that they've been wronged because of the size and shape of their bodies.
Right. Yeah, that's so interesting. Do you have a sense of, you know, you were mentioning, you were discussing, you know, since the start of this year, obviously the political environment around diversity inclusion efforts has changed a lot. There's a lot of countervailing pressures. And then the context of, you know, some of these laws being passed in certain jurisdictions that, you know, feels like things are moving forward. I mean, what's your sense of kind of, are things getting better? Do you think they'll continue to get better? Where is your head at right now, I guess?
Where's my head at right now? Great question. I don't know if we have the time. But yeah, seriously, I think the bigger challenge right now in the conversation about body inclusion is the conversation about GLP-1 weight loss drug medications. In fact, I'm leading a session tomorrow on the plus size market and GLP-1 in the age of GLP-1 medications, because it makes the conversation a little more complicated. And first, I just want to say that the Gorgeous Agency, you know, does not judge anyone who decides to make medical decisions that are best for their bodies. But what we've seen is a dismissiveness about people in larger bodies because these medications exist. And, you know, that all, it all comes back to that idea of weight stigma and diet culture, this idea that we're before and after pictures, right? Just eat less, move more. And it's not so simple. Our bodies are very complicated. In fact, full disclosure, I am on a GLP-1 medication. I need knee surgery. And so I'm still very much in a larger body. I've become a little bit smaller, but I still, you know, carry most of my weight in my bottom half. It's still part of my story. And, you know, I spent last week in urgent care with a dear friend of mine who started one of the medications, and couldn't stop vomiting. I mean, like literally for like a full day. And so I had to take her to urgent care, get fluids, and, you know, it didn't work for her. And she had the same same reaction to a different brand, the right. same kind of medication. And so just because they exist doesn't mean that the conversation is over.
Right.
But the prevailing mentality of diet culture and weight stigma wants people to just be done with it and right. say, like, well, just
fix
take it
so I don't have to deal with it. Yeah.
Exactly. Like, and I made a joke to someone like, oh, unless they put it in the drinking water, like, and, but if they did, like, some people would choose to stop drinking water because it's not for everyone. And, you know, even though the most recent obesity rates just went down, I mean, it's by 0.4%. So yeah. we have a long way to go. And so people in larger bodies have it existed for a very, very long time. And they likely will be around. And so just because that those medications exist, it doesn't mean that this marketplace will stop existing. And so that's something that is really important to kind of keep into perspective, that, you know, people make all sorts of interesting choices with their bodies, in whether it's that or bariatric surgery or whatever the flavor of the moment is. The most important thing is that we respect people in the moment that they are right now. You know, someone might be on that path now, and then 2 years from now might decide it's not for them. Right. So what we have to do is just to make sure that we show up as companies, as humans, for people in the bodies that they exist in the very moment that we meet them.
That's great. That's this has been so interesting. So many things to think about, and just to broaden, you know, my perspective on the way people are moving through the world and coming to work, and how to talk about you know, to talk in ways that are inclusive of everybody. Is there anything else that you wanted to discuss, or any parting words for our listeners before we sign off?
Oh, well, thank you so much for the time. This has been wonderful to have this conversation, especially, knowing that it's going out to folks who are in the legal profession. And these are the people who are really the instigators of change, and mindful approaches to things. If you want to continue being part of this conversation, we do offer the Gorgeous Collective, which is a group of leaders who meet every month and talk about, you know, the important kinds of conversations about body shape and size and the plus size market and how to best approach issues that are going on. And so it's not just for people in retail, it's for all sorts of leaders. So if that interests you, you can go to thegorgeousagency.com/cohort. That will lead you to the collective. But if you're interested in booking a training, like, make sure you book a call with me, and we'd love to set something up. I think this is a great conversation to have in your workplace. And, you know, again, it's not just for your team members, but it's for the clients, the customers that you serve as well. It's this kind of information. It's not only good for you as a human, but also it's great for business as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you, Cara, so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
The Hearing.
Thanks again for listening. And if you're enjoying the podcast, don't forget to subscribe or leave us a review. We also love getting feedback or topic ideas, which you can send to thehearing@tr.com. Bye.
The Hearing, a legal podcast from Thomson Reuters. To find out more, go to tr.com/thehearing or subscribe via iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.